From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The dam protecting much of Orange County from severe flooding is urgently in need of improvements. That's the conclusion of a new report from the Army Corps of Engineers. Prado Dam controls the flow of the Santa Ana River. It sits along the 91 freeway where Orange and Riverside counties meet. We'll look at what it'll take to fix Prado right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you have a wonderful weekend in store. Relax, enjoy yourself. We're going to help you do that with Film Week coming up in the next hour. Coming up later this hour, the federal government pulling the plug on California's high-speed rail funding. We'll consider the state's next move. But first, the Army Corps of Engineers reports the dam protecting much of Orange County from catastrophic flooding urgently needs shoring up. A Prado Dam controls surges along the Santa Ana River. It protects 29 downstream communities, housing nearly 1.5 million people. The dam sits along the 91 freeway where Orange and Riverside counties meet. As the LA Times reports, the Army Corps announced this week Prado Dam's risk characterization has been raised from moderately urgent to high urgency. What does that mean? With us from the Los Angeles Times, staff writer Louis Sahakian, who's been closely following this story. Louis, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
So we've seen so much attention, of course, to the Oroville Dam in Northern California, where they had serious spillway problems, evacuation of more than 100,000 residents downstream from Lake Shasta there. Put this into context, because I know this isn't anywhere near as large as what you're talking about with Oroville, but here you've got a huge urban area downstream along the Santa Ana River.
Oroville Dam is one of the largest dams, if not the largest, in California, if not the one of the largest in the country. At Oroville Dam, part of the problem was a spillway. The concrete slab of the spillway was, it turned out, it was relatively thin, and the foundation was.
I think we just lost Louis on our phone connection there. We'll try and get him back. We're talking about what the issue is with Prado Dam, a report coming out this week, or at least released this week, by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which described concerns about the spillway if the water level behind Prado Dam were to top the dam, that there'd be serious problems structurally for the integrity of the dam. Now, you might be somewhat familiar with the reservoir that's behind Prado Dam. Often it's dry, but during the rainy season or periods of especially intense rain, you've actually got wetlands back there with habitat for all kinds of birds and other species. It's a beautiful area, and right abutting this very urban area, you know, cities like Corona and the like, you've got this open space behind Prado Dam. But the safety function that it serves is to protect all those communities that are along the floodplain for the Santa Ana River. Louis, I think we got you back. So you were talking about how this is different than Oroville, but significant risk.
It's different, but I was beginning to say that there are.
Well, we lost Louis again. So we'll try and let you know what's going on. Apparently, you're just losing the connection with us. 866-893-KPCC if you have questions about Prado Dam and its integrity. Also with us, Martin McCann, who's an adjunct professor at Stanford University. He's the director of the National Performance of Dams Program at Stanford. Yes, that's the name of it. He's a civil and environmental engineer. Martin McCann, thank you, sir, for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
I know that you're not necessarily expert on Prado Dam, but just from what you've seen from the Army Corps of Engineer release, what seems to be the biggest concern about the vulnerability of Prado?
Well, that gets into some details. I haven't seen a report about the analyses that they have done. I do know that the Corps has a very rigorous dam safety program where they look at the likelihood of these events, the potential failure modes at these structures. In the case of a large dam like this, with large inflow flood events that could occur, there are a number of different failure modes that might exist. But in terms of exactly which ones are playing out here as being real important, I have not seen any reporting on that of yet.
Well, with the climate warming and the potential for more extreme weather conditions, both drought and intensity of rain, is that something, to your knowledge, that the Corps is taking into account as it looks at the viability of dams around the country?
Yes, as far as I know, they do. To what extent they consider these issues is very much a site specific problem. But they look at climate change issues because it does affect in particular the frequency of these events, how often they would occur, and potentially how much larger the floods might be.
Back in 2005, when we had a very heavy multi-day rain event, I think that was an El Nino year, if I recall correctly, water began seeping through the earthen extension there of the dam. And so authorities released more water than they would have otherwise to relieve the pressure. And then they sent a flood warning to some of the communities downriver. In fact, over 3,000 residents were evacuated for about 24 hours. Out of concerns for flooding. They used Corona High School's gym as a temporary shelter for those that were evacuated. So that ended up not being a particularly dangerous event, but the concern is, you know, if the dam were to fail and you had intense periods, you know, day after day of heavy rains, that you could end up with the communities downriver along the Santa Ana River inundated. Okay, we're going to try this the third time with Louis Hagen of the Los Angeles Times. So, Louis, pick up again, if you will, talking about the threat here.
Yes, I'll try. The problem at Prado right now is that just a few weeks ago, a performance assessment of Prado Dam revealed that the concrete spillway is relatively thin. And the concern is that if that floodwaters were to spill over the top, it would deteriorate that concrete spillway and flood 29 communities from Anaheim and Santa Ana all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So you were mentioning Oroville. Oroville also had a thin concrete slab. So there is this similarity. These dams were built 50. These are infrastructures that were built and designed in accordance with assumptions about meteorological shifts of a century ago. Climate change has changed all that. We are now seeing whiplash shifts of extreme wet and extreme dry, as we saw when one of the worst droughts in California history ended in 2017 with one of the wettest rain seasons we've ever seen. These dams were built to save communities from a series of storms of the scale of what we saw right here in Southern California in 1862. The problem is that it was once thought that a storm of that size, which, by the way, dropped 36 inches of rain on the city of L.A., would occur every 1,000 to every 10,000 years. But new studies suggest a storm of that scale could happen over the next 40 years. One more thing about all this.
Yeah, real quickly, Louis. Yeah.
We saw Oroville, now we've got Prado, and 2 years ago, Whittier Narrows was determined to be among the most dangerous or highest risk dams in the United States. So it's 2.5 million people now that are facing potential flooding.
Yeah, because I think you write in your piece for the LA Times, Lewis, that the Whittier Narrows Dam, because of all the residents who would be threatened if it failed, that's the highest priority for work, and work is scheduled to get underway on that. Joining us now from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Oh, no, we don't have her quite yet. All right. We're trying to get her lined up to join us. Lillian Doherty, who's the Division Chief of Operations, can talk with some detail about what the plans are for the Prado Dam. You might notice that if you drive up or down the 71, the Corona Freeway there, right where it intersects with the 91 freeway, that's where Prado Dam is. You can see it from both the 91 and from the 71, and it's being increased in capacity right now. They're doing quite a bit of work on the area behind the dam, habitat restoration, attempting to increase the capacity. To build up the dam itself there. And so, Lewis, this has been going on quite a few years, hasn't it?
It's been good. Well, it's the improvements that began in 2002. But this new discovery, it's unknown at this point how much it will cost or even exactly what they have to do to make that spillway safe. It's unknown how much it's going to cost.
All right. So and is work underway, to your knowledge, on the Whittier Narrows Dam, or is that still to commence?
No, it's still to commence, but they know what they want to do there. The money is committed of roughly $600 million, and work is scheduled to begin in 2021.
Is it your sense that the near catastrophe at Oroville and the mass evacuation there, that's kind of lit a fire under the Army Corps when it comes to assessing these dams, particularly in California?
As a matter of fact, it did. But it's one of several concerns and events that have occurred in recent years that have made the Army Corps go back and take a hard look at its portfolio of 600 dams in the United States, 27 of which are high risk, including Whittier Narrows and Prado.
Lewis Sahakian of the Los Angeles Times, his piece in today's paper outlines exactly what's going on with the Prado Dam review. Lewis, I know you need to go. Thanks so much for talking with us this morning. Also with us, civil and environmental engineer Martin McCann, who directs Stanford University's National Performance of Dams program. Martin McCann, did the Oroville incident in Northern California, has that led to a sped-up timeline in review of dams elsewhere in the country?
It has in some places, and I would say it's really ongoing. For example, in California, there was an initiative to look at spillways similar to Oroville and Prado. So there were immediate initiatives that were undertaken, and I think the lessons from Oroville are still to be learned and acted upon, because there was an awful lot that came out of the independent forensic study that the industry is going to have to address.
Yeah, do you think the argument that climate change, the warming of the planet, and along with it, more extreme weather conditions that California's, at least in recorded history, been prone to anyway, but with that being intensified, is this just going to mean there's going to have to be significantly more attention paid and expenditures for this?
I think potentially the dam safety question in California and in the nation as a whole is one that has been gaining more and more attention over the last 2 to 3 decades, and it's been slow in coming, but it's been progressing. It's been improving. Oroville was a wake up call for California, certainly. Unfortunately, no one got hurt, But it was a wake-up call, and I think the nation as a whole is sitting up and paying attention. And as you just heard, the Corps of Engineers, you know, has focused their attention on spillways, and so we have this situation with Prado Dam. I will say, though, that the Corps has an excellent dam safety program. Whittier Narrows has been pre-Oroville on their radar and recognized as a very high risk and needing attention. I don't know for sure whether or not Oroville changed that. There may be an emphasis on speeding up the schedule, but it was already on schedule to be addressed. But I think the nation as a whole is well aware of what Oroville means to dam safety in general, and folks are paying attention and slowly making changes.
Well, and we don't think of Southern California. We don't think a lot about the rivers here because we go through such prolonged periods where there's little water in our rivers. But when you think about the San Gabriel River and the Whittier Narrows Dam and its responsibility there, and you think of Prado for the importance along the Santa Ana River, these are huge infrastructure projects of great importance to Southern California. We have with us now from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the division chief for the operations of the L.A. District, Lillian Doherty. Ms. Doherty, thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
What is the timeline for making improvements on Prado Dam to make it able to withstand spillover during an intense series of storms?
You know, I do need to back up for just a moment. So in May of this year, as part of a periodic review, we identified potential issues due to non-compliance with industry standards. So our team is currently in the field, actually daily at this point, identifying what those requirements would be. So I can't tell you definitively at this point what the time frame is, but we are looking to do interim risk reduction measures in very short order, and then the longer-term measures would be done at a later date. But we do need to identify what we need to do first. That's the primary objective at this moment.
The ongoing project for the land behind the dam, where there's wetlands restoration going on, the capacity's being increased, and I think there's already work to raise the level of the dam. Is that, to your knowledge, going to provide some mitigation to the current risk?
So those are separable sort of activities. We are looking as part of that project, however, where they do kind of come together, is that project is looking to raise the spillway. Now, what we determine in the short term about what needs to be done could influence the design of the raising of the spillway, which is estimated to occur and be completed by 2023.
All right. And is the money allocated, the millions of dollars necessary to do this, or is that potentially going to delay addressing the needs in this report?
So because we have not yet identified what needs to be done, it's difficult to say whether additional funds would be needed, whether it could already be wrapped in with the monies that have been allocated to raise the spillway. I don't know that I can answer that question immediately, but we are looking to identify what those costs are going to be and whether additional funds are needed. Additional funds may be needed for interim risk reduction measures. Again, that's in the short term, working with communities and improving public outreach and doing measures to reduce the risk that we have identified associated with the spillway.
The dam is nearly 80 years old and was designed even before that point. How much has been done historically since the original construction?
There's been quite a bit of work. We have teams on the ground on a weekly basis, and we have teams operating and maintaining. Under the Santa Ana River Main Stem project, it was improved in significant ways. We've extended the embankments. We've raised the main embankment. We've modified and improved and built a brand new control tower and outlet structure. So there's quite a few improvements that we've made since that time. The one thing I do want to emphasize is that even though our infrastructure is, in fact, 80 years old, it is dry most of the year, and historically, it's never gone to spillway. And it continues to perform exactly the way it was designed. Last year, we had more rain than we've seen in Southern California, probably in the last 20 years, and it performed exactly as it was intended.
All right. I want to thank you very much, Ms. Doherty, for being with us and talking about this. And once you have more details on the cost and the specific fixes, I'd love to talk with you and see what the plan is for Prado Dam. Thanks very much. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers L.A. District Division Chief Lillian Doherty on the report that just came out this week that Prado Dam rises to the highest level of urgency for assessment for retrofitting because of concerns over possible deluge to 29 Orange County and Riverside County cities downriver along the Santa Ana River. Terror Talk on 89.3 KPCC. The federal government has pulled the plug on a significant grant to California's high-speed rail project of nearly $1 billion in federal money that had been allocated for California's bullet train now not being made available. The question is, what is the state's next move, particularly with eroding support for high-speed rail? With us from KRON 4 News in the Bay Area, Sacramento Bureau Chief or Bureau Reporter Ashley Zavala. Ashley, thank you so much.
Larry, thanks for having me.
So not a huge surprise about this because Gavin Newsom, the governor, had in fact gone toe-to-toe with President Trump over the bullet train. So now the administration in D.C. has pulled this money. What's likely to be the state's next move?
Well, judging by the governor's response yesterday saying that, you know, they're planning on defending this money in court, it sounds like a lawsuit is brewing. The attorney general, actually, when, you know, this whole thing first started in March, the back and forth between the federal government and the governor, essentially, the attorney general would not comment at all on those recent developments with that money being threatened, saying that it was likely he would be representing California in a potential lawsuit. And then, you know, yesterday I reached out to the attorney general's office and they basically told me to go away because, you know, they don't comment on client issues. So that seems to be what could be down the pipeline.
I wonder if with the eroding support for the project, even here in California, the governor talking about it, you know, being scaled back in his State of the State address, and you've got in the Central Valley some significant pushback on the project, even though, you know, it's that region that would potentially benefit from the Bakersfield to Merced leg that the state intends to build. I mean, does that all make it more difficult for the state to challenge this in court?
I think it really might be, and especially because you know, the people representing those districts that are directly impacted by this initial segment, this refocused plan of Bakersfield to Merced, the majority of them are adamantly opposed to this whole plan. And then, you know, so you have back and forth in the legislature, and it's not even, I wouldn't even say it's a partisan issue because there are some Democrats, you know, concerned that this isn't helping any of the districts outside of, you know, Bakersfield to Merced as originally envisioned. So it may be hard to fight in court. And given that, you know, the federal government yesterday, they didn't just send out a, you know, 2-page letter saying, hey, you know, your funding's gone. They sent out a 25-page letter with an attached 89-page contract and then, you know, several exhibits showing ways in which the state did not comply with the agreement and that the agreement really said, you know, it was the Bay Area to Anaheim and not this, you know, valley-to-valley segment that is refocused.
Ashley, the legislative analyst last week put out a report addressing a number of concerns with the project. To your knowledge, do any of those concerns intersect with the issue of state compliance with the terms of the federal grant?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was there was a handful of major concerns the LAO presented to the legislature last week at a hearing, actually, where the Secretary of Transportation, Brian Annis, was present, as well as the outgoing CFO, Russell Fong, of the High Speed Rail Authority. And the LAO said, one of the biggest concerns is that there wouldn't be sufficient funding for just the Bakersfield to Merced line if the federal money goes away. So there was already concerns about even having funding for, connecting San Francisco and Anaheim to this project, because there is none appropriated at the moment. But now there's, the funding level is really in question for this refocused project.
Is there a plan B under consideration if the money isn't there to go to Merced?
So the state auditor recommended that by May of 2019, now there be a contingency plan, and last week it would make sense for the High Speed Rail Authority, at least this is what lawmakers say, that it would make sense for them to present that contingency plan at this hearing with one of the budget subcommittees of resources and transportation. But they didn't really give one. They noted that the end of the month is still a couple weeks away, and I guess they have time to present one, but that essentially this new vision of Bakersfield to Merced and the project update they released recently, that was really the plan they're banking on.
Okay. And so if the money isn't there, do you know if there's an appetite in Sacramento for some sort of a tax increase or something to backfill those federal dollars with state funds?
Sure. Some of the advisors, have presented options. The LAO has also presented options to lawmakers, whether that is in the form of a tax increase, whether that, includes private fundraising, getting more private money to invest in this project. But as of right now, there has not been a discussion, like a solid discussion about, okay, what do we do without this federal money? It's always been this confidence that the federal government and California were going to work together, and they were confident that it was going to be fine and that this money was going to, come through. But now they need to come up with a plan.
Is anybody talking openly about trying to buy time in case President Trump is defeated in the election in 2020, that then there would likely be a friendlier Democrat to California in the White House and that the funding could resume? Is there any talk about bridging till then?
Not yet. And again, there has been talks that they're confident that, California and the Federal Railroad Administration at least could come together, because, the president and leaders at the national level have an interest in these nationwide infrastructure projects. Other states talking about a hyperloop, and of course California wanting this high-speed rail, in the largest state in the country, would make sense that, the national government would be, or federal government would be interested in this. But as of right now, there hasn't been any talk about what would happen if another administration came in and maybe the talks were more friendlier.
We're talking with Ashley Zavala of KRON4 News in the Bay Area. She's Sacramento Bureau reporter for KRON4. We're talking with her about yesterday's announcement by the federal government that it's withdrawing nearly $1 billion in federal grant for California's high-speed rail project. You heard Ashley describe the state legislative analyst in that hearing last week saying that the money's not there if the feds pull those funds to get even to Merced from Bakersfield. So the question is, what is the plan B if the state's not able to prevail in court challenging the withdrawal of the federal funds? Ashley, before I let you go, for Democrats particularly, there's sort of the image of this whole thing, which was a pet project of Governor Jerry Brown and had voter support initially, and Democrats fully on board with this. Are there any sort of off the record conversations where some Democrats saying, well, maybe it's a blessing in disguise if the feds pull the money, maybe it's a graceful exit for us that's less embarrassing?
No, I really haven't heard that. And Democrats have been pretty mum since besides Gavin Newsom. They've been, pretty quiet since the federal government first threatened the money. But now, I mean, there's some San Jose Senator Jim Bell came out and said that, this is not right, and that the federal government is in the wrong here, and that, people are the concern on the Democrat side is, the jobs lost, the debt, all the money that would just be out the window if this project isn't completed in some way, shape or form.
And the visual reminders with, overpasses and all just sitting there unfinished. It's
exactly.
It's hugely, aside from the money lost, those stranded dollars, it's the huge embarrassment of those images.
Exactly.
Ashley, thanks very much. Good to talk with you today.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Thanks. Ashley Zavala, KRON4 News in the Bay Area. She covers the state capitol for KRON4. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming right up, we talk about the death of SB 50 in committee yesterday. That's the bill that would have overridden local zoning controls for higher density housing along transit corridors. The LA City Council, San Francisco Board of Supervisors, both unanimously urging opposition to the bill. We'll find out what happened right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. You know a bill's controversial when anyone's even heard of the number assigned to it, such is the case with SB 50, which died yesterday in committee. It's a controversial housing bill that would have overridden local zoning laws that under state mandate would be opened to high-density construction along transportation corridors. The LA City Council, San Francisco Board of Supervisors both unanimously voted to oppose SB 50. There was tremendous pushback from homeowners groups throughout the state who thought that this would run roughshod over the single-family communities they represent. But now with the death of SB 50, the question is there another plan for the state to try and dramatically increase housing starts? With us, Cal Matters reporter covering housing, Matt Levin. Cal Matters and the California Dream Project, a collaboration between KPCC and other statewide news organizations. Matt, good morning. Thank you for being with us. Were people surprised this died yesterday?
Yes, absolutely. And most noteworthy, I think Senator Wiener, Democrat from San Francisco, the controversial author of this legislation, was kind of taken aback. They knew this was going to be a tough fight to get this bill through the Capitol, but they had some early successes with earlier committee votes. They weren't expecting the bill to die at this point, this early in the process.
He had a version last year which didn't go through. Now this tweaked version this year that hasn't gone through. I assume he says he's going to bring it back next session.
Yes. And he has also given indications that he's going to try as much as possible to revive it this year, although technically the way the Capitol works, it's going to be very, very difficult for him to do so without legislative leadership and maybe even the governor strong-arming it. More likely, the earliest this bill can be revisited would be in January of next year. And Wiener is not going to back down. He's going to be bringing it back as soon as he can.
Well, and when I talked with the governor, I guess it was about 3 weeks ago, he didn't sound fully enthusiastic. I know that originally he was supportive, but he sounded to me like he was backing away from it, given all the opposition that you're hearing from communities in the state that would be affected.
So the line that Newsom has kind of consistently used is, I'm supportive of the idea, but I'm kind of unsure of the details. And it was interesting, after news that the bill had died broke, Newsom released a statement saying that he was disappointed in that outcome and that increased production of housing along transit corridors has to be part of a solution to the state's housing woes. I think that also speaks to the fact that, you know, Newsom has laid out this very ambitious goal of 3.5 million new homes in California by 2025. It is difficult to see how he gets to that goal without some of the changes that a bill like SB 50 would bring.
This, though, doesn't make, you know, him the bad guy if it had passed, and then he'd be incurring the wrath of all these different right. neighborhood groups. So from a political standpoint, this might actually end up being more protective of him. You know, what's your sense of this pushback? Was that, did that seem to be the factor that led the committee to kill it, or do we know?
So you can even pin it even more specifically on one or two legislators in the Capitol. So Senator Anthony Portantino, a Democrat from La Cañada Flint Ridge, who represents Burbank and Glendale and a couple other communities you know well, he was really the one, because of his position on this specific committee, that said, okay, we're not going to hear this bill anymore. We're going to end it for this year. The real question is, why didn't legislative leadership lean more on him to force the bill through? He had been hearing complaints from especially Pasadena and homeowners in Pasadena and city officials in Pasadena that this bill was going to disrupt all of their local planning plans. Sorry, that's a little redundant.
But I understand exactly what you mean. It's accurate, yeah.
But the other question is, why didn't the president of the Senate pro tem, the leader of the state Senate, Senator Tony Atkins, why didn't she force him to get this bill through? And I think that's a question that has yet to be kind of sufficiently answered yet.
We know, of course, that housing advocates are hugely supportive of this. Are there, you know, is construction industry, real estate industry, have they been putting a lot of lobbying muscle behind SB 50?
Oh, for sure. And not just them, the realtors, which are a big political force here in California, have put a lot of muscle behind it. And then also some tech firms have put some money behind it, trying to, you know, make it cheaper for their employees to live relatively close to where they work. Wiener assembled a very powerful coalition this time. I mean, he got the AARP to endorse the bill. It was much broader than his attempt 2 years ago, and yet even still, it did not advance very far in the process.
We're talking with Matt Levin, who's a CalMatters reporter covering housing for the news nonprofit and for the California Dream Project, which on which CalMatters collaborates with KPCC and other news organizations here in California. We're talking about what appears to be the death of SB 50, the controversial housing bill, at least for this legislative session. So maybe there's some sort of a Hail Mary that brings it back this session. But it would appear Scott Wiener, the state senator who introduced the bill, is going to have to wait till the next session. Matt, what then is he going to have to do, do you think, to get additional support behind the bill if he's going to move it?
That's a very good question, and I'm sure there are political consultants that make much more money than I do that hopefully have better answers for Scott Wiener. You know, what's interesting with this session in particular is there was always this notion that SB 50 would be part of a broader housing package where you would get certain special interest groups to swallow their distaste over some bills in exchange for something like SB 50. A good example is a couple of the tenant protection bills that are still making their way through the legislature now. You know, the theory being if we can get SB 50 through, then the developers and the realtors and even the landlords will kind of hold back on their opposition to things like a rent cap or just cause eviction protections, right, which they have a lot of distaste for. That possibility of a grand sweeping housing package that has both tenant protections and some production component like SB 50, that took a huge hit when SB 50 came off the table yesterday.
All right. So I guess we'll see what, if anything, on the housing front comes through this current legislative session. Matt, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Thank you so much, Larry.
Thanks, Matt Levin of CalMatters. He specializes in housing as his beat, talking about the demise yesterday in committee of the controversial plan SB 50, which would have overridden local zoning for transit corridors, allowing higher density construction in those areas. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, the future of the Boeing 737 MAX jets. That's to come in 1 minute on Air Talk. Film Week is coming up right here on KPCC in just a few minutes. We'll hear what our critics think of John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum, starring Keanu Reeves and Halle Berry. The Sun is Also a Star, a romantic teen drama starring Yara Shahidi, and A Dog's Journey, Dennis Quaid, Josh Gad star in the film, from director Gail Mancuso. She's known for the work for many years in television. She's been one of the most booked directors of high-profile episodic TV. She's now directing this feature film, and she'll be joining us in studio on Film Week coming up next hour right here on KPECC. But our attention right now turned to the future of the Boeing 737 MAX jetliner. This week, the acting chief of the Federal Aviation Administration defended the agency's safety certification of the MAX. The plane, of course, involved in two deadly crashes. Chief Daniel Elwell said the FAA's decision not to ground the jet until other regulators around the world had already done so was the right decision at the time. This part of a congressional hearing. And Elwell also stood by the agency's long-term policy of using employees of aircraft manufacturers like Boeing to conduct the inspections on their own company's work. With us to update us on the review of the MAX jets, what's going on, how soon they're likely to return to the air, and whether passengers might be balky about using those jets, is David Gellis, who writes the Corner Office column for the New York Times Sunday Business section. David, good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Where do we stand on the review? When is it likely these jets get back in the air?
Just yesterday, Boeing announced that it had essentially finished work on the software update that it's created for the 737 MAX. Now, that doesn't mean that the FAA is reviewing it yet. What's happening right now is that the FAA is working with other regulators. They're all trying to get on the same page. And then sometime, maybe next week, but it could be a week after that, Boeing and the FAA will go up in one of these fixed aircraft for a certification test flight. And after that, Boeing can then officially submit this fix to the FAA, and then it's going to take some more time before the FAA and potentially other global regulators actually say this plane is ready to go again. So we are looking at potentially June, perhaps later, before the 737 MAX is flying commercially again.
Initially, it was a little unclear what the problem was with both of the jets that crashed. Was it a faulty sensor issue? Was it how the avoiding of the stall automated system kicked in? Is it fully understood exactly what went wrong in both of those flights?
The final crash investigations have not come out yet. So until that happens, we really won't have the final verdict from the authorities that be, who are conducting very rigorous, very thorough investigations into both of these crashes in Ethiopia and Indonesia. What it is clear, however, and Boeing and the FAA are all on the same page here, is that this new system known as MCAS, M-C-A-S, was central to both crashes. This system was added to the 737 MAX because this plane had larger engines that changed the aerodynamics of it from previous generations of the 737. And so in order to prevent stalls They added this system that pushed the nose of the plane down in certain conditions. This system relied on only one so-called angle of attack sensor. And what happened in both these instances is that these sensors got damaged. It started sending bad information to the flight computer. The computer thought the plane was going to stall, even though it was flying perfectly level, and it started pushing the nose down. The pilots weren't able to control the plane, and tragically, they both crashed.
So the failure of the sensor, the then misreading of the software, the MCAS system, then what about the pilot override? Has it been determined there was a lack of training, that the override didn't work properly? What is the thought about what happened with that?
So again, until the final investigations are done, it's going to be very hard to say either way conclusively. What we do know is that the pilots in the Ethiopian crash followed at least the beginnings of the procedures that they were instructed to do so in the event that this system started to malfunction. What's also true is that this system was much more powerful and much more aggressive than many people, perhaps even the pilots, realized. So even as they tried to get control of this system, they were having such a hard time because it repeatedly and persistently, very quickly, started to push the nose of the plane down. So pilot error may or may not have been a part of it, but it certainly wasn't what set this train of events in motion.
So just to clarify, and I understand we don't have the final word, but is it unclear whether the pilots, in attempting to override MCAS, were able to do so? I guess what I'm wondering, is there a flaw in MCAS that it couldn't be overridden, or that the pilots didn't understand how to override it? Do we know that yet?
You know, I don't believe that there's been a final enough determination, and I'm reluctant, as a reporter who's trying to hear both sides out and get all the facts, to come out and say that myself. I've heard persuasive arguments on both sides. I've talked to longtime pilots who fly this jet who say, listen, these pilots, looking at what we can see from these preliminary crash reports, did everything right. I've also talked to very seasoned pilots who believe that the pilots in Ethiopia perhaps didn't do everything they could have. So again, I'm not going to be the one to make determination. But what is clear is that there was a system that was little understood on this plane that set in motion the events that led to both of these crashes. And I think that is what the FAA and Boeing and pilots around the world are hoping gets fixed very, very quickly.
We're talking with New York Times Sunday Business Section writer David Gelis. He writes the Corner Office column as well as other features for the Times. Also with us from USC's Viterbi School of Engineering, director of the Aviation Safety and Security Program, Thomas R. Anthony. Mr. Anthony is also former manager of the FAA's Civil Aviation Security Division for the Western Pacific region. Mr. Anthony, thank you very much for being with us. What is your sense as to whether, I mean, is there clarity as to whether the MCAS system could have been effectively overridden by the pilots?
Well, I think, Larry, the key thing here is that while the MCAS is very important, that we need to look at the root cause. As an investigator, we really can't determine what all the faults are, what all the hazards are of the system, until we run them back. The MCAS is a solution. It is a solution to aircraft performance handling that is a result of using a larger engine, which is the result of getting better fuel efficiency. But the point is that MCAS is the result of decisions that were taken and analysis that were done within Boeing and within the FAA that decided. So it's really that decision tree and those analyses that need to be examined in order to get to the root cause. The fact is that in addition to the or during the evolution of the MCAS, engineers were tasked with producing drawings twice as fast as they normally do. Now, was that a hazard? Was it analyzed? Were additional resources put onto it? And so did that create a hazard in itself, that increased production tempo? Additionally, the question that pilots are asking is, are there any other changes that were made in the aircraft that were attendant to changing it to the max that
we don't know about yet?
And so that's a big deal. In the old days, we used to point to the last person to touch the airplane, and we would say, pilot error or mechanic error. But today we have a mature understanding of how accidents evolve, and they can start all the way up into the corporate offices, the training offices, the finance and budget. Those are where oftentimes the accident causation can start. And that, as an investigator, that's where I think these investigations will lead.
All right. I want to thank you, Thomas Anthony of SC's Viterbi School of Engineering, where he directs the Aviation Safety and Security Program. As you heard, the 737 MAX jets from Boeing looks like they're not likely to be back until June at the earliest. It looks like more and more. You essentially got two companies that make these jets. It's Boeing and Airbus, and that's pretty much it. So a lot of attention to pay to what went on with Boeing and the procedures there to certify the airworthiness of the MCAS system on the MAX jets. I want to thank our terrific AirTalk production team in advance of Film Week here, our senior producer, Fiona Ng. Our producers are Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, Caitlin Plummer with us this week. We appreciate her so much. Jonaki Mehta also with us this week. Our news apprentices, Matt Bynum and Ari Saperstein. Parker McDaniels, our engineer, and we also thank all of our terrific people who helped us out this week for just a single day. You're listening to Air Talk and Film Week on KPCC. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. A lot of movies to talk about this week, as well as director Gail Mancuso. She has a featured film out this week that we're going to talk about, A Dog's Journey, but a noted television director from Roseanne, and I mean, you name it, Friends, the list goes on forever of all the episodic TV she's directed. We'll talk about that shift, as well as Women in the Director's Chair. That comes up later on Film Week. We are joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian, and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, and Wade Major, film critic for Synagogues.com. We begin with the action film John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. Keanu Reeves stars as the retired but still deadly hitman Chad Stahelski. Chad Stahelski is the director, and Lawrence Fishburne, Ian McShane, and Halle Berry co-star.
I'm not service anymore, John, so I don't go around shooting people in the head.
I'm not asking you to kill anyone. I just need you to get me to him.
To who?
Your old boss.
You want to kill Baratta?
I'm not going to kill him. I just need to talk.
What could he possibly give to you?
Guidance.
A lot of whispering.
What
did you think, Wade, of John Wick?
Yeah, she doesn't go around shooting people in the head until about 5 minutes later, when both of them are shooting a lot of people in the head. That's the only reason people go to see these movies, is to see a lot of people get shot in the head. They have the highest body count of, I think, any movies that I've seen in decades. So the John Wick films all basically scratch a particular cathartic itch, which is to watch this Clockwork Orange-style ultra-violence so that we don't carry it out in our own lives. And they go above and beyond. They go to a ridiculous extreme. The body count is just astronomical. It's on a John Woo level, from his Hong Kong films. And each one of these movies has sort of upped the ante since. Each one is about a little bit longer. This one's over 2 hours now. The last one was right at 2 hours. And now it seems like everyone in New York and pretty much everyone in Morocco, where this detours to momentarily, is an assassin. They're all out after John Wick. The bounty on his head is even higher now. And the mythology is even more elaborate. You know, we've had this mythology of the International Assassins Organization and the rules they follow and the hotels that they're not allowed to kill each other in. And now it gets even more elaborate. There's this high table, and Aja Kate Dillon plays the adjudicator who comes and casts judgment on John Wick. And before long, it's impossible to really keep track of all the rules that they have. But you don't really care. It doesn't make sense that he goes to Morocco to see Halle Berry and something happens in the desert. None of that makes sense. But you don't care because the action scenes are so elaborate, so well choreographed, so much fun. I laughed like I've never laughed before. It was a lot of fun, and I don't care that it makes no sense.
Four accredited screenwriters to try and make it make sense.
Yes.
I like making sense of this. I might be one of the only John Wick fans who actually enjoys all the talking scenes as much as all of the killing. But I like this strange deadpan society that he lives in. Angelica Houston shows up in here. Everybody's sort of threatening. They never smile. They're very serious. And there's this huge weight of ceremony and obligation and forcible tattoos to show that you did this thing. I mean,
even among the ladies who work the switchboards and everyone has those tattoos.
I enjoy all of it. I mean,
that's a great name for a rock group, right? Forcible tattoo.
Forcible tattoo. If you come to our show, I mean, the killing here is, of course, like the highlight for most people in the audience. And they do, I find, a good job in making them interesting. I get really zoned out at like the end of the Avengers when a million people get mowed down with guns. I'm like, whatever, I don't care. But here, it's very smart. The first fight is with books. There's a knife fight that's spectacular.
That knife fight is through the roof.
It's amazing.
That is amazing.
A fight with horses that I was like, okay, we're getting a little into like Arnold Schwarzenegger on a horse riding through a mall territory. But they rescue it. There's several dogs. You heard one of them breathing in the back of that clip. I mean, I enjoyed so much of the choreography in here. There's a motorcycle fight scene that I don't understand how they shot. And like my boyfriend is a director, and as we left, he was like, I don't understand how they shot that. It's really outstanding work that they're putting together here.
It is what John Woo was doing in the early 1990s with The Killer and A Better Tomorrow and all of those films, where you know that it's outrageous and outlandish and that it's preposterous. But the choreography of it, the execution of it is so operatic. So there's a carnival-like glee to just working out in your head, how did they put that together, especially the knife fight. That knife fight, which occurs fairly early on, is rhythmic. It's almost like a song, and it's like a ballet. There's something amazing about every single one of these, and they keep getting more and more outrageous.
This reminds me of the best of the martial arts films.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of that. Starting in John Wick 2, they brought in a lot of Hong Kong talent and a lot of Chinese talent to give it that quality.
If there's people who are Raid fans out there, you'll enjoy a nice cameo.
Thoroughly, yes. Mark Dacascos, who's getting on in years, doesn't do a lot of action films anymore, but he plays the main nemesis here, and he does it beautifully. It is very tongue-in-cheek. Also worth noting, too, these are all in a chronological continuity. Every John Wick film picks up exactly where the previous one left off. There's no sort of a day later, a year later. They are all three of these films are a straight through line.
Does it stand on its own, though? I mean, if you haven't seen the previous, are you okay watching this?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you've never seen any of the other ones, it might be interesting to watch a film that starts off with the hero already battered and bruised, and you're like, how is he going to survive the next 2 hours?
There is a lot of reference to – they always reference that this all started because of a dog and because of a stolen car. So it does help to have at least seen the first one so that you know how ridiculous it is that they keep upping the ante and upping the ante. They do seem to be making up the mythology as it goes along a little bit, but I kind of don't care. Also, quick note, Lance Reddick, who has been the concierge in the previous two films, finally gets a gun.
All right.
They finally give him a gun.
Chad Stahelski, who directed it, did the previous John Wick films. He's a stunt guy also, I understand.
Yeah, I think that's really what gives these movies like the oomph and the real life sweat.
John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum, starring Keanu Reeves and Halle Berry. It's rated R in wide release. The Sun is also a star, romantic teen drama, directed by Rai Russo-Young, and written by Tracy Oliver. The film stars Yara Shahidi as a pragmatic teenager who believes in science and facts, but not love. Everything changes when she meets Daniel, and the two fall in love.
What are the five key ingredients to falling in love?
Fine. Mutual self-interest and socioeconomic compatibility.
Well, my ingredients are friendship and chemistry. Mm,
of course they are.
My last three are some sort of moral compass. Common interests are a must. And let's see. The X Factor.
What's the X Factor?
Don't worry, we've got it.
The film is The Son is Also a Star, based on the book by Nicola Yoon. Amy?
You know what? I liked this movie a lot, Larry. This movie, I mean, it's about this young couple. They meet on a really pivotal day. Yara Shahidi plays a girl whose family is poised to be deported the next day back to Jamaica. Her father moved her here when she was a child. And so she's running around this whole day in New York trying to meet with her lawyer, meet with different lawyers, go to different agencies, see if anybody can help her out. She runs into him on the day that he's supposed to have his interview to get into medical school, which is really important to his parents. He's a first-generation Korean-American. And so they have this like kind of time pressure backdrop on this day of running together, but also a lot of forced time to have to hang out. And this movie is such kind of – it's very much like saying – A Before Sunrise set in New York. This movie loves New York. They have just this way of looking at all the people around them, taking in Harlem, Chinatown, Greenwich, all these neighborhoods that this couple bounces to on this like epic day. And there's just so much affection for what America is and what it should be. And these two kids as part of America, it just really won me over for a movie that is, granted, maybe like a third of the running time is just staring at these two beautiful teenagers. I mean, Yara Shahidi, she's a really strong screen presence. She comes from like Grown-ish and Black-ish. Melton is in Riverdale. And the camera just watches them, bathes them in neon light, has them kiss in real close-up all the time. The music's dreamy. It just works. It just does.
I could see it, Amy. You're entranced by the movie. That's great.
I seem to say this every week, but I cried at this one too, and Amy always makes fun of me for that. No, I did. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, and Yara Shahidi is a revelation. She's going to be an enormous star. This pushes a lot of the same buttons as all of the movies that sort of follow a similar pattern. We could call it the Before trilogy, Before Sunrise, the Linklater films with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. Man and a Woman, you know, the French film from way back. It has all of those same poetic qualities. And the thing that you may not even realize, because it's so much about New York and America and the melting pot, apart from a guy, an extra on a subway with a throwaway line, there are no Caucasian speaking parts in this film. And you don't even notice it until the end. And there's
something, I didn't even notice that. Wow.
I know. And there's something kind of remarkable about that. It's very much in her family, in his family, and then a few other peripheral characters. But it's very intimate. It's wonderful. Their chemistry is extraordinary. And I think the chemistry is what really drives the film more than anything else. You just want to see them together all the time in every frame.
The Son is Also a Star, teen romantic drama starring Yara Shahidi and Charles Melton, Rye Russo Young. The director, Tracy Oliver, adapted Nicola Yoon's book. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. A Dog's Journey, also a wide release this week. It's a family adventure comedy directed by veteran of television comedy, Gail Mancuso. It's her feature film directing debut. The movie's a follow-up to the 2017 A Dog's Purpose. The film is co-written by Maya Forbes, Catherine Michon, and Wallace Wolodarski.
Today was a good day.
Well, I finally got a call from the cruise line.
Gloria spent a lot of time talking to her hand.
And they needed a singer for their stagecoach lounge. I know.
There's nothing in that cup.
Oh, did you make me a cup?
Mama.
Thank you. Well, it's perfect for me, right?
Delicious.
That delicious?
Wait, there was something in that cup?
The film is A Dog's Journey, rated PG. Amy?
Yeah, that clip is a dog not understanding what fake tea time is to a toddler and being incredibly confused. A Dog's Journey is in the same universe as A Dog's Purpose. That was the movie where the dog died and died and died and died again and came back as different dogs in order to learn that its true purpose was to love Dennis Quaid, its original owner. And Dennis Quaid is here. The dog is now an older dog. They're both old people living on this farm. And Dennis Quaid has a granddaughter who's father has died before she was really born, and that's Dennis Quaid's son-in-law. And so this whole movie is Dennis Quaid sort of bequeathing the old dog when it passes on to the old world, because Dennis Quaid has realized that this dog keeps being reincarnated for a purpose to protect CJ, the granddaughter, when she's taken away by her mom, Gail, who's a cruise ship singer, wannabe singer, kind of bitter. Here, put in this film as basically being like the worst mom of all time in a way that's borderline really cringeworthy as you're watching it. So the dog is now reincarnated to protect CJ as she grows up, as she goes through high school, as she has terrible boyfriends, as she moves to New York to become a singer, has more terrible boyfriends, and then finally falls in love and is happy. And the dog's really annoying. I have to say that up front. I mean, you could hear a little bit of the dog narration there. The dog has a way of, you know, being there as comic relief when, say, like, people are talking about cancer. And the dog is over there in the corner being like, I wish this bed was made out of bacon. And you're thinking, dog, we don't really need to hear from you at this moment. And yet I cried. I think it's been that kind of week, too. I don't know what's happening. You kind of can't get around crying when you see dogs die or people hugging dogs and the people dying as the people are hugging a dog. Even though this is a movie that has a literal rainbow bridge that the dog runs over. I mean, I don't know what to say about a movie like this, to be honest. I mean, there's so many of these dog movies lately. Just in January, I think I might have been on here talking about A Dog's Way Home. That was another movie about a dog trying to find its owner, narrated by another very annoying dog. What if dogs aren't really this annoying when we get to hear inside their head? What if they're actually very smart and lovely?
Well, it's all relative, right? Dog's Journey is the adventure comedy starring Dennis Quaid, Josh Gad, Gail Mancuso, the director, and it's written by W. Bruce Cameron, Catherine Michon, Maya Forbes, and Wally Wolodarski. It's rated PG. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the Swedish sci-fi film Aniara, also The Souvenir, which stars Honor Swinton Byrne and Tilda Swinton, I believe mother and daughter, right, starring
That's
in this
right.
film?
Yep.
So we'll hear about that and the biographical doc, The Serengeti Rules. Those and more movies coming up with our critics. Do want to remind you our next Film Week screening, Saturday night, July 27th at the beautiful historic theater at Ace Hotel, downtown on Broadway. It's Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, 7 p.m. The screening followed by post-film conversation. We're going to have a lot of fun talking about that movie, which follows the adult film industry as it becomes the home video industry. Great ensemble cast, so many terrific actors, and P.T. Anderson's screenplay. Tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. Back in a minute. Very appropriately, the University of Pittsburgh is getting the archives of the late horror filmmaker George Romero. Given the fact he loved filming in Pittsburgh, makes sense that Pitt would end up with his archives. The university announcing the acquisition this week. Scholars, students, filmmakers will be able to see the original annotated Night of the Living Dead script, a foam latex zombie head, and so much more. Sounds like quite the horror film tourist attraction at the University of Pittsburgh. We continue with our Film Week critics, Wade Major and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the Swedish sci-fi drama Aniara. The film is written and directed by Pella Kugerman and Hugo Lilja. Amy, what'd you think of Aniara?
This is a low-budget sci-fi film that I cannot recommend highly enough for people who want to see something ambitious, epic, emotional, gigantic, smart, depressing, and a little nihilistic on what looks like a fairly low-budget format. What this film is about is it starts off with just a quick montage showing the destruction of the Earth with global warming, getting through that very fast to get to just like some sort of average people, middle-class folks, taking this transport ship to go and live on the moon. And you can see when the camera kind of glances around the faces that something awful has happened. A lot of people are scarred. A lot of people are brutal. But the ship itself is sort of like a mall. You know, it's kind of a cruise ship taking people on what's supposed to be a three-week journey that ends up becoming much, 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 much longer. And really kind of the driving character of this is a woman who operates this kind of station on the ship called Mima. And what Mima is it's where you can go in and lie on the ground and sort of meditate for a bit and sort of picture your life past on the earth. And Mima helps get inside your brain and give you this image of the things that you miss. And that's what you think the film is going to start being about. But then it really just becomes about the society around it and this woman who running Mima becoming sort of a notorious figure on the ship in a way where you see her popularity rise and fall and rise and fall. I mean, this film just feels sort of like this epic, epic tale, the kind of thing you would see a James Michener novel about, taking place on this ship. And it's just really stunningly well done.
We're talking about the Swedish sci-fi drama Aniara Wade?
I'm a little less enthusiastic, but guardedly. So this is based on a 1956 epic poem by Swedish Nobel laureate Harry Martinson, which is a poem I've never read, but it was also turned into an opera a few years later, and it's very popular in Sweden, and it's inspired generations to you know, with its ethical questions. And the idea in the poem is there's a ship, just exactly as Amy describes, taking people to Mars, and it winds up getting knocked off course, and before you know it, a three-week trip to Mars turns into decades in space, and these people have to now question what is the meaning of life, and is there purpose to our lives anymore if we have no destination, if we're going to just be trapped here in space forever. And that's a
it
really...
must be 3 weeks to the moon.
Yeah.
You said Mars, right?
It's Mars. No, it's
oh,
Mars.
It is Mars.
Yeah, it's Mars.
Three weeks
to Mars. Well,
not
that's...
bad.
It's a fast ship. It's a very interesting premise, and it raises all kinds of fascinating existential questions. And the way they handle it in the film is very interesting. You know, when you skip from year one to year two to year three, and it is episodic, but yet it is not episodic at the same time. The problem is that once you move from epic poem to movie, now you have to sort of harden some of your scientific considerations. And I sat there thinking, okay, why didn't they have a backup system? Why aren't there other ships that could come and rescue them? You start kind of going through all the logistical problems inherent in the scenario.
Is this what you asked yourself when you saw Titanic?
I did. Absolutely. Absolutely. But there are scientific reasons for that, and that's a document of history. So once I was able to get past some of that, then I was able to sort of absorb some of the bigger existential questions. And on that level, it's aspiring to be a little bit like a Tarkovsky film, like Solaris. It's going in some of those...
That's what I was saying is Amy was describing it.
And you know, again, Tarkovsky, Russian director, but worked in Sweden. When you live in Northern Europe and it's cold, you spend a lot of time wondering about life. And so it does have that quality to it. But I had to hurdle a lot of scientific considerations, a lot of logistical issues in order to get there.
Aniara, the Swedish sci-fi drama, is rated R at the New Art Theater in West L.A. The mystery romance The Souvenir stars Honor Swinton Byrne, Tom Burke, and Tilda Swinton, written and directed by Joanna Hogg. Wade?
So Joanna Hogg is a top-tier, really first-rate independent filmmaker in the U.K. This is a very, very well-crafted film that follows a somewhat well-worn premise. And the premise, Honor Swinton Byrne, who is Tilda Swinton's daughter and is making her her starring role here. She was in I Am Love as a young girl about 10 years ago, but with her mom again. But here she carries the movie, and Tilda is in a supporting part as her mother. And she's a young film student who is making a documentary about dock workers and meets a man who works for the British government. And they wind up having a troublesome affair. And in terms of movies that tell you about people who get into relationships that turn out badly and go south very quickly, this doesn't really pioneer any new ground. You're watching this because the performances are so good and because Hogg has a really interesting visual style, the way that she composes her actors in the frame, the way she directs them, is very, very compelling. I would say even though the movie is generally kind of unremarkable in where it goes to a very familiar place. Honor Swinton Byrne, that's an apple that fell right next to the tree. She is astonishing. She is a power talent in her own right, and we're going to see really big things
from
her.
So this isn't just nepotism. This is
talent. Oh, no. This is real talent. And, you know, her father is a Scottish playwright, so there's a lot of talent there as well.
Yeah, a lot of genetic powerhouse there. Amy, what did you think of The Souvenir?
Yeah, I mean, this is a film that people just worshipped coming out of this year's Sundance. It's the sort of film I feel like I'm always trying to like a little bit more than I do because it is just so handsome. It's so wonderfully done. You can tell you're in the hands of like a filmmaker who knows exactly what she wants this film to be. You know, it's very reserved. It's very beautiful. I think to me the standout here is Tom Burke, who plays the bad boyfriend. He has this face that you cannot decide if you want to rescue him or push him off a cliff. Like, he's so perfect in that. And this movie is set in the early 80s, so he shows up in these ridiculous like posh outfits. I mean... It's an impressive film. I think for me it's a little hard to love, but I'm glad to see it.
I agree.
And our Justin Chang apparently just loved this film.
He loved it. I think almost anybody else you would have had on the show would have loved it maybe more than the two of us. All right.
So we'll keep that in mind. The film is The Souvenir. Joanna Hogg, the writer-director. It's rated R at the Landmark West LA and the Arclight in Hollywood. The biographical documentary, The Serengeti Rules, is directed by Nicholas Brown. It's his feature directorial debut. Wade?
What an amazing documentary this is. Yeah, really extraordinary. It takes its title from the book of the same name by Sean Carroll that was published about 3 years ago. But the central figure here is Bob Payne, who is a zoologist who died the same year that the book was published in 2016. This movie wouldn't exist if not for Bob Payne. Nicholas Brown actually was able to track him down on the eve of his death and interview him basically in his deathbed for several hours. And that interview, intercut with other interviews with other scientists who are all inspired by him and his work, is what forms the backbone of this film. And the photography is extraordinary. And what it is, this is basically a nature documentary about the fate of the Earth, about biodiversity, and how human beings have inadvertently changed the ecological balance of the planet. And the chain reaction that you get by changing one small thing, if you attack something at the bottom or at the top of the food chain, how does that impact not just the rest of the food chain, but every other part of the ecology that relies on the food chain being what it is? And what they find is both depressing and incredibly encouraging, which is that we have impacted things in ways we never imagined. But at the same time, nature is resilient and finds a way back and has shown us the way to repair it and to enable it to repair itself. It's a miraculous documentary. It's really extraordinary.
The Serengeti Rules at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. It's unrated. The British horror comedy Slaughterhouse Rules with a Z is directed by Crispian Mills, and it stars Asa Butterfield, Simon Pegg, and Nick Frost. Amy.
Yeah, this is the sort of film that if it had come out in the late 90s, it would have been a massive cult hit. And now I fear it's sort of like in this modern world of film, it's going to come and go very, very fast. But what it is it's a very, very fun movie, kind of dumb, kind of goofy, set in a British boarding school with Simon Pegg as one of the professors, Nick Frost as an ex-student living out in the woods, and a cast of sort of young people, Asa Butterfield is one of them, who go to this school, which I would describe as sort of a punk rock Harry Potter. You know, there's people classified into different groups. There's the snobs and the losers and the jerks. And this being Britain, and if anybody ever follows like any of the sex dramas coming out of the British boarding school, like the one that kind of implicated the Prime Minister David Cameron a few years back, there's a lot of sex in here, a lot of like curious initiation rites. And meanwhile, as all this tension is going, all these teenagers are figuring out who loves who and what do we do. There's mysteries about the boy who killed himself last year and what's really going on with these people who are fracking in the woods outside the school. And why does the headmaster, Michael Sheen, feel okay with that? And why are people dying? And it builds in a very comic way. There's giant fights and explosions and things. I mean, if I was in high school, I would have been super happy to discover this film on the video store library. You know, as it is now, I'm sort of like, you tried, it's great. And it almost just makes me sad I don't live in that world of the 90s anymore, where I would just worship this film.
And Margot Robbie makes an appearance here.
Very, very briefly. She plays a girlfriend who's long distance, and she shows up over Skype. I almost wonder if she had to even
that's
like,
pretty funny.
If she could just Skype in from whatever else she's
Skype
doing right now.
Skype cameo in a film. Slaughterhouse Rules with a Z is at the AMC Atlantic Times Square in Monterey Park. It's rated R. Trial by Fire, a biographical drama telling the story of Cameron Todd Willingham, executed in Florida for killing his three children. Ed Zwick, the director, Laura Dern, Jack O'Connell, and Emily Mead star. Wade?
This is kind of a classic miscarriage of justice film. It follows a fairly well-worn template that we've seen in movies like Dead Man Walking and Murder in the First, and even to some marginal degree things like The Verdict and To Kill a Mockingbird. It's essentially about this guy. He's put on trial for a crime where there's tons of evidence, and he presumably didn't do it. And a faithful attorney steps in and tries to work the system. And the only thing that kind of sets it apart is that Ed Zwick, who, of course, we've known for a very long time, all the way back to Glory, a co-creator of 30-something.
Yeah, I was going to say, acclaimed TV before them.
Yeah, Ed Zwick is a really, really accomplished director. He knows how to close. And even though this is a very familiar subject and goes in kind of a predictable direction, he really, really works it. And you are immersed in these characters. And that's what sort of elevates it above what it would otherwise be.
What do you think, Amy?
I mean, I was really excited to see this because the case in question, Cameron Todd Willingham, has become fairly famous. There was a large New Yorker article about it a few years ago.
Which this is based on.
Yeah. The title is actually taken directly from the New York article. And what it is about is, you know, he was convicted on bad science about arson that has since been disproven. And it was also the last days of the satanic panic. So the investigator said he poured gasoline on the fire in a pentagram. And what they were hoping to prove with Cameron Todd Willingham is that if they could prove, even after the fact of his execution, that he was executed unjustly, that he was an innocent man, they've been looking for a case to take all the way up to the Supreme Court, which still may or may never happen. Rick Perry has been shutting down. He was shutting down when he was in charge all further investigations of this crime or of what really happened. So that said, I was really excited to go watch this movie, but I thought it was just so kind of dryly, faithfully done, the sort of movie where every character walks in and says exactly what's on their mind. You know, I feel this and I feel this, that it doesn't really come to life for me. But it's at its best when they get into the science and how the science was rigged. And it is at its best when it kind of gets into the idea of just Cameron himself. He's a guy who was kind of a drunk, a ne'er-do-well, a lowlife of the town, the kind of guy that you could sort of imagine having done this. And it feels like the town convicted him just because they already didn't like him and wanted him to go away. And so when it gets into issues of class and convicting a man who wasn't a saint, I find it more interesting.
Trial by Fire, the film starring Laura Dern, Jack O'Connell, Emily Mead, a screenplay from Jeffrey Fletcher, based on a New Yorker article by David Gran. Trial by Fire, rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena, the Landmark in West L.A., and Edwards West Park in Irvine. Coming up, we're going to talk with director Gail Mancuso about her feature directorial debut, but that after years as the highest of profile television comedy directors. Back after this. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope you have a great weekend going. Heard a little bit about movies that are worth your time. Now we turn our attention to the art of making movies. And someone who's had an extraordinary career in television, directing many, many episodes of television classics from Friends, 30 Rock, Scrubs, Roseanne, quite the career in Hollywood as a television, primarily comedic director, but also doing episodic dramas. But she makes her feature directorial debut this week in a movie that we were just talking about, A Dog's Journey. We're going to talk with her about making that transition, also about being a real pioneer as a women's director in television. Gail Mancuso joins us, multi-time Emmy winner, multi-nominee for Emmy Awards, and our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, joins us as well, president of the LA Film Critics Association, and just importantly, former roommate of Gail's. It's another claim to fame, right?
That's my bigger claim to fame, for sure.
Gail, let me start with you. The transition to doing feature film. I mean, here you're someone extremely well known in the television community, and now you're making a feature film. Was it in any way like you're sort of starting over again, the fact that it is somewhat different than doing episodic TV?
You know, first of all, hi, Larry, and thank you for having me. And hi, Claudia.
Hi.
I miss you. It really was very, very interesting because it was a seamless transition for me. Because having done so much television, the wonderful thing about TV is that you get to practice your craft almost like every day. So episodic TV, like I do mostly comedies, you know, you prep for like 3 to 5 days and then you shoot for 5 days. So every week I'm on the set articulating direction to actors, working through story points, building characters, finding jokes, setting up shots. So making that transition to features was just seamless because it was just, okay, I'm back on the set.
Well, about just sort of if there's a different psychological approach. Because, I mean, one of the things about radio is it just goes out into the ether. You make a mistake, you kind of move on. There's a show the next day.
Yeah.
And I think of television, maybe not that much because people are watching these episodes years into the future. Nonetheless, the pace of television, I think of it as sort of less able to be perfected versus a film where you've got budget limitations and others. But still, you can go back, you can reshoot, I would think. Is that at all a little different of a psychological approach?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, look, I mean, it's history. You're making history with a feature, as well as with TV shows, too. But this is even more so. So I wanted to make sure that we were doing it absolutely right. And every, you know, in the editing room, I was saying to my editor, Rob Komatsu, I'm like, OK, we're making history here. Big red letter day. Should we use the close up or the wide shot? No. But it felt the whole process was very natural to me. And I think a lot of that has to do with I had wonderful support from Amblin and Universal and Holly Barrio and my producer, Gavin Pallone, just amazing, talented people that really gave great notes and were collaborators. And I think, I don't know if that would be true on other films.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It just seemed to be a really good first fit.
And I wonder about the control issue, because in television you've got showrunners who, you know, they have their Bible, and you've got actors that, if the series has been on for a while, have considerable clout and say as well. So you come in as the director, is that much more limited than doing a feature where you've got final say?
Yeah, I mean, that was like the best part of doing a feature, because it is a director's medium, and so everything from the script, helping develop the script with the writers, all the way through the shooting process, all the way through the editorial, it's, you know, I just had a massive
must
say.
Must felt like, yeah. Wow, wish it was like this all the time.
Yeah, I loved it. I kind of like it. Was a
Well, you walked into a property that it already existed, too,
yes.
In the sense that there was this is a sequel to A Dog's Purpose.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, my thought was, you know, your first film, and you're doing what W.C. Fields said never to do, working with kids and dogs. How hard is, I mean, that must have been a challenge.
You know, that's a great question. Well, first of all, I want to say about the sequel aspect of it. I wanted to make sure that this movie, A Dog's Journey, stood on its own, that you didn't have to see A Dog's Purpose to understand what was happening in Dog's Journey. So hopefully that happened. But once you did see this movie, that you would go back and see A Dog's Purpose, because that's a great movie also, of course.
But the working with animals and with kids, that's got to be a challenge.
Yes. Actually, I love working with kids, and really there was only one child, which was Emma Volk, who was 2 years old. I gotta take a sip of water.
All right. Claudia, let's talk about women in television, because Gail, you know, with all these, you know, many, many episodes of television she had done, we've talked about in the film industry, it's only recently that we're starting to see critical mass of women directing feature films. And it's a long time coming.
I think films have been behind television in that regard. And it's really, that's a shame for films. But, you know, with the wealth, with the blurring of the lines between TV and film now, and with streaming services and all of that, I think, you know, there's going to be more mixing and going back and forth, which I love. And you see something like Queen Sugar that Ava DuVernay created, and then she has all these women directors coming in. That's, you know, they work in that. It's episodic. Then they go and work in films. So I think we're seeing much more going back and forth. What do you think?
I totally agree with you, Claudia, as usual.
It's the roommate thing.
And I think it's a roommate thing. But there's so many platforms now which you can get your material on, in terms of like Netflix, Amazon. There's, you know, so it's just a wonderful time to be a director. And you know, back when I started, there were three, maybe five broadcast channels back in the black and white days. No.
How many women were coming into the business at the time you started?
I could count on one hand. Now I can count on two. No, maybe three. But yeah, it was very, very limited, and also very little mentoring was done at that time. And now the tides have turned, and there's just a lot of programs out there, not only for women, but for diversity. And So we're saying this is a great time for all you young filmmakers out there, or old filmmakers, anybody who wants to, has a message and wants to do their own film. Now's the time to do it.
Well, we joke that, you know, virtually anybody, it seemed, get a, you know, Amazon to, you know, or Netflix to put money out to make something. But that's got to be a way of giving a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have had a chance to do so. The other thing is you can make an amateur film so inexpensively now that in a way that you couldn't before. You'd have to go to film school in the past to get a camera and, you know, film and be able to make a movie. Now kids growing up can do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how is that changing the business, Gail?
I think everything is for the better. I think it's great. I think, you know, people have their stories to tell and they're able to tell it, you know, however they use, you know, YouTube or whatever, they put their material up. And you could still use that as part of your reel. Hopefully you'll still go to school and learn the craft.
So you think more. Film school is important? Because some people, like Quentin Tarantino told me, said, no, we think, you know, there's no more point in going to film school since anybody make a movie. That's all you needed film school for in the past, he said, have access to the film.
Well, I think what's great about film school is that you get to work with like-minded people, and you can, and as a community, you're building your community, and you're helping each other out. And I think that's really important. I think the other important thing is just to have life skills and being able to enjoy and travel and meet, you know, different people and be part of different cultures and all that. I did want to get back to your child question really quick, if you don't mind.
I don't have time for it right now, but we'll have to come back to it later. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with Emmy-winning TV director Gail Mancuso, who this week, her feature directorial debut, A Dog's Journey, is out in wide release. She's directed such classic series as Friends, Scrubs, 30 Rock, Dharma and Greg, Modern Family, and many more. And our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, also with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about women in film and television, and we welcome your calls, 866-893-KPCC, back in 1 minute. It's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking with our Film Week critic, president of the LA Film Critic Association, Claudia Puig, and we're talking with noted television director Gail Mancuso, who's made her feature film directorial debut in The Dog's Journey, starring Dennis Quaid, that's out this week in wide release. And we're talking about Gail's journey as someone who's one of just a few women directing in episodic television from the early days of Roseanne and Friends and all these classic sitcoms, all the way up through the rebooted Roseanne as well. Two-time Emmy Award winner, multi-time Emmy nominee. And we're talking about the transition from television to film, as well as more women coming into both television directing and into feature film directing. If you want to talk about the increasing representation of women in film, we're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Okay, now we have a chance, Gail, to talk about working
Claudia's,
with animals.
Yeah, Claudia's question from before, which is so great. I was going to say, the other actress, Emma Volk, who was 2 years old, she's obviously a child, but Abby Ryder Forston played 11-year-old CJ.
She was great.
How great was she?
Yeah, she was a really good little actress.
Her first scene, and this is why I say she's an old soul. Her first scene was the scene where she came and went toe-to-toe with Betty on the sidewalk there and told her mom off.
And, about keeping the dog and saying you've been a bad mother and all that. Wow.
How great was she?
That was a really good scene. Yeah.
And in terms of your animal question, it was great working with the animals because we had wonderful, wonderful dog trainer, Bonnie Judd. And
just one dog trainer for all those dogs?
She was the main one, and then she had her whole team to help with all the other dogs. But she trains through positivity and really good reward system. So after every scene, everybody would break out in cheers. Yay, you did that. So it was like one of the happiest sets I've ever been on in my life.
What about the monitoring of animals? I know that's a big deal now.
Yeah.
So you had someone on set the time whose first job is to look after the animals?
Oh, someone's. We had a whole crew. So we, you know, being an animal animal lover myself. I have five dogs.
You were the perfect person to direct.
Was I not the perfect
person to
direct it?
You had no break from dogs.
Well, the problem is that we shot out. I was away from home, so I got my dog fix on a daily basis because I miss my animals
so much. Those dogs are so cute. All dog lovers should see this.
I know. So we had APA represented on the set, American Humane Society. We had. The dogs had their own security room to go from set to the trailer. We wanted
to make
sure.
They have their own personal assistants.
You know what? There was somebody giving them coffee. Yeah. I'm just kidding. But they were such.
Treats provided.
They were amazing, fun, and just happy, happy, happy dogs because they were in a happy environment.
As the first woman to win an Emmy for directing a comedy series, that was for Modern Family in 2013. You feel any sense of responsibility to women who are coming up in television as a result of having that honor? And how? What are the ways in which you try and respond to that?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm part of many different organizations. I was part of the television. I was a governor on the Television Academy, and we're part of that internship program. There's a lot of programs out there that young students can apply to that help, you know, mentor them through like through shadowing and stuff. There's a great new program by NBC Female First that I'm on the board of, and they have a wonderful program where, you know, thousands and thousands of applicants, you know, applied, and very few get in, but the ones that get in get to actually not only shadow on a certain show, but they are actually guaranteed an episode to direct. It's the first of its kind. Jennifer Salke originated that program.
Are these young people coming out of film school?
They're not. They're anybody. There's commercial directors. They're just people that haven't done episodic or maybe just one episodic television episode.
But in some way, they would be able to display. They have the ability to direct an episode, even if they've never done it.
Yes, because you have to have a reel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the Directors Guild of America, they have a great program, a dynamic and diverse program that I'm part of also.
I would think that a lot of this is about women being in executive management positions.
Yes.
Because not stereotype, but men necessarily notice the gender differences in representation. How much of a difference is made as more women are moving into these managerial positions?
Well, I think that's a great question because I think women will rise each other up. I mean, I think we need women who are in these managerial positions to help elevate new women coming into the business. And I think now that it seems like there is a more equal opportunity for women in managerial positions to do the hiring, I'm hoping to see more female directors coming up.
Claudia, as a film critic, what do you see as the difference in terms of not just women directors, but representation of women on screen? Do you feel as though that there's a broader array of women's lives that are depicted? And has that changed?
Slowly but surely, it's changing. Not as quickly as we would like it to change. But I think when you have a woman director, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a more nuanced and dimensional portrayal. I would use as a negative example, perhaps Palms, of, you know, that we talked about it last week. It's not particularly the characters are very one-dimensional. But on the other hand, you know, when you do have a woman director, you oftentimes find women in lead roles, as your film was. It was really about a woman, a girl who grows up into being a woman and her dog. And I think it's just automatic if you are a woman director, you're going to want to see well-developed characters. And so I think, you know, I when you're talking about the NBC program, I noticed that, you know, Jen Salke, being the head of NBC Universal, they have a lot of different programs. I was actually a juror on a diversity film festival, short film festival, and they draw those people, a lot of these short filmmakers, and they find, you know, they help them launch careers. So I do think, you know, having women in high places in it, being able to green light, makes a huge difference. And then not just having women as directors, but also producers, editors, writers, crew people, you know, that's still, we're way behind in that. I think last year only 8% of directors were women, and producers higher, 26%.
Cinematographers, 4%. I mean, there's a huge
4% cinematographers are women.
Yeah,
that's the hardest area. I mean, when you're trying to, we have Rachel Morrison.
Yes, Rachel Morrison's wonderful,
fantastic.
But the fact that, you know, we can only name one or two people.
Does it seem at all that the women don't think of that as a field to go into, and more women need to be recruited into the pipeline, or what's going on with that?
I don't know. All of the above, mm-hmm. because, I mean, because, you know, when even in television, you know, I'm looking for people in all different areas of the crew, and that seems to be the area, the camera department that has
resistant to the change.
Not resistant. I don't know if that's the word, but maybe the support system isn't in place yet. Have that.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us. Appreciate it. Gail Mancuso is the director of the new film, A Dog's Journey, her feature directorial debut, but she's a veteran hand when it comes to directing actors with episodic television, the first woman to ever win an Emmy for a network television comedy. She's worked on all the great series of recent years. Gail Mancuso and our Claudia Puig, Film Week critic, president of the LA Film Critics Association, former roommate of Gail as well. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope to see you for our next Film Week screening, Saturday, July 27th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown, the beautiful, historic, former United Artists Theater, Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, 7 o'clock on that Saturday night. Tickets, kpcc.org/inperson.